you are so fortunate for what you have, but there are people with so much less, and they're so much happier than a lot of us. And what does that tell me? That we all can just cut down on stuff, and you can be happy with less and simple. And I've never forgotten her. I have a photo with her. And if I ever get to go back to Fiji, I'm going to find her. And that is why when I say to everyone, Fiji changed my life and this race changed my life, it did. In a split second.
Welcome to the Sam Gash podcast. These are conversations with trailblazers, rule breakers, and those who pave their own lane and venture boldly into the unknown. By entering this uncharted arena, they inevitably stumble, yet they all display an ability to innovate and contribute, even when the odds are not in their favour. We skip over their highlights reel and go into the guts of who they are and what they believe in. I'm your host, Samantha Gash, and I'm an endurance athlete, a former corporate lawyer, and social impact entrepreneur. It is my absolute privilege to create the space for these guests. If you found these conversations to be of value or have any feedback, please subscribe, rate, and review, and I hope you enjoy. I'm very excited to bring with you this incredible guest, Mindy Zemrak. She is an Emmy-nominated casting producer of Shark Tank. She's the head casting agent there and has been with Shark Tank through its 12 seasons. She is also head of competitor relations at the World's Toughest Race. If you applied for the 2021 Patagonia season, your application went through to her. She is the person in the know, the gatekeeper, the pitch master, the most organized person I know, and she is a lot of fun. We talk about her zigzagging journey into casting, what casting really means, dispelling some of the misconceptions about what the role actually entails. At the tail end of the conversation, we go into her life-changing experience on the World's Toughest Race. Mindy's incredibly special person. I hope you guys love this conversation and enjoy. Mindy, I am so excited to have you on the podcast. We've been talking about it for quite some time, and I'm delighted our schedules finally collided in a perfect way. Now, before we get going, it looks like you are in a hotel room right now. Whereabouts are you?
I am in an undisclosed location in Las Vegas, finishing filming of Shark Tank in a bubble.
I mean, when anyone ever says they're in an undisclosed location in Vegas, it can't be a good thing.
In this instance, it's just fine. We're able to safely, in a COVID world, film the show, and we've been very fortunate to be where we are and doing it so far with no positive cases or anything. So fingers crossed we can finish it.
That's epic. So this is season 12.
Season 12.
And when did you guys kick this off? And what have been some of the structures that the team have put in play to be able to go back into production safely?
So we're actually one of the very first shows, big shows in the U.S. to start production up, which is a feat in and of itself. We typically film, we call them pods, pod one and pod two. We usually film pod one in June and then the other one in September, just purely based on shark schedules. And this year, I started season 12 in January. And I had two open calls, actually one here in Vegas and then one in Dallas, Texas. And I had like seven more lined up between March and April and May. And this, I remember like it was yesterday, the day that we got sent home, I think it was Friday the 13th or somewhere around there in March. How ironic. It may have been the 14th. And all of a sudden it was like a domino effect. All the open calls had to cancel. We had to start working from home, but I literally remember thinking like, oh, this will pass. This will be over really soon. And that was not the case. Cause then 5 months later we were still working from home. So there was a time where it was like, all right, production was actually figuring out and building two full plans, one to film in LA at Sony, which was normally where we film. And then one in Vegas is kind of like a backup. And then as the cases surged in July in LA, it was like, we have to make a decision. And it actually makes sense to be in a bubble here because you're contained. You don't drive home. You won't get exposure from anyone or anything. You can't stop at a gas station or a restaurant on the way home. You can't go out at night for a drink or whatever. So production had a massive feat to overcome because you have to test 200 plus people. We have entrepreneurs flying in from all over the country. They have to quarantine for 8 to 10 days in a hotel room. And when I say quarantine in a hotel room for 8 to 10 days, they literally cannot leave their room, not even to get ice, because they're exposed to plain air and everything. So these entrepreneurs are committed. The sharks get tested. I get tested every 3 days while I'm here. So it is a gargantuan feat that they had to put in place. And that was with policies from ABC, Sony, MGM, all the unions and guilds. And, I think there's a lot of eyes on us to see how it's going to get done so that other shows can maybe follow suit. And I know smaller shows are kind of back up and running, but we're one of the bigger ones. And again, we're just really fortunate to be doing this year, because it could have gone the other way where we just didn't film.
I mean, it is amazing. And I also love this idea of people putting in their extra skin in the game for a possibility. I mean, to kind of commit to 8 days to whether or not you're going to get to the next step. And I think it also like enhances people's resolve. Like if they're willing to go through that threshold, they are that bit more committed.
Yeah. And I think that, it's crazy to see how this whole pandemic has affected businesses across the world, but especially in our country. And it's just, some have thrived and flourished and their sales are through the roof, and others have completely struggled. If they're in retail and brick and mortar, like that doesn't exist. Some states it does, some states it still doesn't. Normally a time commitment for Shark Tank was 5 days. Now you're looking at 12 days. So it truly is a testament to how much, like you said, skin in the game, and how much they're committed to potentially getting their shot in the tank. And, that we couldn't do this without the entrepreneurs. So we owe a lot of thanks to them for wanting to still do it.
Have you seen a reduction in like number of applicants?
Oh no, we still saw just as many. I was afraid that we weren't, once I canceled all the open calls, because we had to, I was like, I don't know how many people are going to apply online, because that's the only way to do it. And we had more than we applied last year, which was a good problem to have. We have anywhere from 20 to 30,000 people apply each year. And it's my team that goes through all of them. So we did it.
Now, we are definitely going to go to your organizational skills later on in this conversation, because I truly believe through seeing it myself that that is one of your master strengths. But I was thinking about pitching, which is something that you see all the time. And I'm sure you see the good, the bad, and the real ugly. You see people pitch themselves in written form. You see people do it on videos. And then you see it in person when people are pitching to the sharks. So how about we swap things right now and you pitch yourself, what you do, what you believe in to me, so people who have no idea about you can get a sense of Mindy.
I don't know that I've ever had someone say, hey, you pitch now. Wow, you're really putting me on the spot. I don't know. Now I feel nervous for the first time. Before I pitch myself, there's this ongoing joke actually that I think a lot of people will find interesting, is when we have an open call, I give everyone a speech to kind of, get them excited and, hopefully calm some nerves. And I always use the same example. And one of my casting producers, her name is Erica Hochberg. If she's listening, she's going to love this, because I always give an example of there's a difference when you're pitching. There's a difference between, hi, my name's Mindy and I make really good cupcakes, and my name's Mindy and I make the best cupcakes ever, and here's why. And so she actually made me a wrap gift of a mask that says Mindy's Cupcakes on it, because that's the example I use every time. I'm not going to pitch you my cupcakes though. But if I had to pitch myself, my name's Mindy. I'm a an Emmy nominated casting producer. I've worked on 12 seasons of Shark Tank. I've worked on all kinds of other shows for ABC, HGTV, MTV, you name it, NBC, CBS. I'm from a small town in Maine, and I've been very fortunate and worked my butt off to get where I'm at. And I like to just kind of encourage everyone to be positive and never give up. Always keep trying, no matter what it is, Shark Tank or completely unrelated, just keep going after your dreams, because I think I'm a testament of, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I went for it kind of blindly, and it's all working out in my favor because I believed in myself. How was that?
You did an awesome job. I would certainly give you the tick of approval. You know, casting agents, I think it's a really mysterious profession. You know, there's a lot of people who are applying to be selected for things. And obviously you hold that information, and the relationship that you might have with production or studios is something that probably so few people actually understand. So if I was to kind of ask you what a casting agent was, how would you describe it? And I do get that perhaps based on what show you're working on, it could look a bit different, but if you could just give an overview on it.
So the casting, my department and I, like my team, our job is to vet people, basically. And it doesn't really matter what show you're on. You're always going to vet someone, whether it's people for a cooking show, or it's for Entrepreneurs for Shark Tank, or if it's for a Japanese game show that I also filmed in Japan years ago, or the very first show I ever worked on was called Crown, the Mother of All Pageants. we can get into that if you want. But you always are vetting people. And what the key of vetting people is, depending on the show, sometimes you're looking for crazy personalities, a lot of energy. But also you're looking for backstories, what they've gone through, what struggles they've had to overcome, because that resonates with viewers and people that watch, I would say 95% of the time. Shark Tank, we always talk about, and I tell everyone, it's 50% about your business or your product, and then 50% about your backstory. Because you could have the coolest thing since sliced bread, and maybe you've raised a ton of money, and then maybe Barbara or Damon call you a gold digger. That's up to them. It's their money. They can talk however they want. But if you have an interesting backstory, and you have struggles you've overcome, or if people didn't believe in you, or if you gave up your kids' college fund, or moved in with your parents, your 401k, if you're all in, that resonates with so many more people you could ever imagine. So it's our job to kind of extract those stories of what makes A, B, C, and D unique from each other, from X, Y, and Z. And so we just have to kind of read people and be really easy to talk to so that people open up and trust us. And, you know, I think it also goes for, depending on the show you're working on, like it kind of sets a tone. Like if you're working on Married at First Sight or 90 Day Fiance, that's probably a completely different casting process than, you know, Shark Tank or Japanese game show or, you know, dating shows or anything like that. So it's really truly finding what sets people apart from one another and kind of seeing how we can tie them in or what obstacles they've overcome. But again, it varies show to show, but we just are in the process of vetting people and their stories.
And then you take that to the production team to go to the next level.
Correct. So then my job is, once they kind of pitch me on the people that they've spoken to, I then have to go to the executive producers of whatever show I'm working on and say, here's, you know, 50 people from this first batch that I want you to look at, and here's their stories and what makes them all stand out. And then eventually you send that to the network executives, and then you have to pare it down somehow. So there's a lot of steps and it's a lot of moving parts, but I never thought I would get into casting. It never even was something I ever thought I would be doing, because it wasn't even on my radar, but here we are.
I find this career path so fascinating. And I mean, now there must be a lot more roles in casting than there were when you were, you know, a kid. There are so many different TV shows on a multitude of platforms. But growing up in a small country town in Maine, you know, I'm presuming that you possibly didn't even know what casting was. So let's backtrack to like when Mindy was younger. You're growing up in this town. Firstly, is the town that you were in, is it close to Portland, Maine? And then let's talk about like that journey towards LA.
So Portland is in Maine.
Yep.
And it's the northeast corner of the United States. So you can't, anything past that, you're either going to go up to Canada or to the Atlantic Ocean, basically. But it's a small, relatively small state. But yeah, it's over there.
Considering you now live in like LA, you couldn't be any more further away from your home.
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Maine. I'm from a small town of 7,000 people. I actually grew up, so I live like, this may sound weird to some people and it may not, but where I live, my parents are high school sweethearts. You know, they didn't go to college. My mom went to college later in life. I was an only child for 10 years and my neighbors were boys. So I grew up fishing with my grandfather, riding dirt bikes, riding four-wheelers. I was the ultimate tomboy. But also, I took dance lessons and was a cheerleader and played softball. So I had my thing. But all my friends lived in a place, and I'm not making this up, they lived in a neighborhood called Smiley Acres.
What? Smiley Acres?
Smiley Acres. So they all lived close and what we called in town. So if I ever wanted to go see my friends, it was like a 10-15 minute drive to go see them. And rarely did they come out to my house. So it was kind of a bummer. But I grew up there. And at the time, I absolutely hated living where I lived. And it wasn't until one night in college, which I'll get to in a minute, that I kind of had a light bulb go off. And I was like, oh my God, I actually had a good childhood. And my parents did the best they could in a small town. I kind of lived in a bubble because now being exposed to culture and just society in LA, it was like a total culture shock for me. But I originally thought I had a couple different phases. I wanted to be a dolphin trainer for a while. I wanted to be a Disney animator for a while. And then I wanted to be a lawyer because I heard they made a lot of money. And then by the time high school rolled around, I was like, I want to be a psychologist. So I enrolled my freshman year of college in a psychology program, very small university, only 2000 students in Southern Maine, right on the Rocky Coast. Beautiful. Like, we had a lot of parties at the beach houses. and then halfway through my freshman year, I was talking on the phone with my dad, and we were talking about his brother, my uncle, who lives in Northern California. And on the side, like, he's an accountant by day, but he was starting a film festival out of his own pocket. And then their first cousin, my second cousin at the time, he's passed away since, but he was a vice president of business affairs at MTV. And my dad started talking to me about films, and they wanted to like shoot an indie film. And Sam, it was like a light bulb went off. I was like, I want to do film. Now, I had never picked up a camera, developed any sort of photos. I never filmed any. I was never the film geek, you know, running around as a kid. That was not me. And I was like, Dad, I really want to transfer. My mom was like, wait, what?
What was it? What was it about like hearing about your uncle creating this like film festival? What was exciting about that for you?
I don't even know. It just was like, that's it. There was no, that sounds cool, it's exciting. It was, no, this is what I want to do. And I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just knew I wanted to work in it. And I honestly couldn't tell you because I don't know what it was, but it was something that was definitely calling to me to go and pursue. And so I applied to 6 different colleges around the country. 3 of which I did not get into in Florida, which was fine. No offense to people in Florida, but I didn't get in. That's okay. Because, eventually I got into the number one film school in the nation, but I actually was enrolled into a very, very small Catholic university, 8 miles outside of the Amish country. And they had a curfew, which as a former kind of, you know, had my fun in college, I was like, I don't want to go to a Catholic university and I don't want to go a place where there's a curfew, but like, if it means I can do film, sure. And then like, I think a month later I got my acceptance into USC. University of Southern California is the top film school in the nation. They only take about 50 students a year into the critical studies and into the production side of their programs. But when I applied, I didn't know that they were private. So I didn't know how much they cost. I didn't know they had an amazing football team. I didn't know anything. I just heard they had a good film program. And so I applied. I didn't get into the film school the first or the second time. I only got into the general school, like whatever that is called, I forget. And then I applied 3 more times into the film school and I finally got in, I think my junior year. And then I graduated after that. And then I was like, all right, well, I want to edit. So I'm going to be an editor. I loved editing, but I also hated LA. So I was like, I'm going to move back to Maine because I don't need to be here to do what I want to do. So I moved home and I took jobs bartending again and waiting tables. And I ended up working. I got a feature film, a low budget horror feature film.
They're always, those horror ones are always low budget.
So much fun to work on though. Like, I was covered in fake blood. Oh, it was great. We filmed at the same prison the Shawshank Redemption was filmed at. It was amazing. It's such a cool place. And then I did a short stint on House Hunters for HGTV. And then I got another independent feature film. And then a year had passed and I was like, I'm ready to go back to LA. And so I secured a job at the New York Film Academy summer program as a camp counselor. So this might explain a lot to you. I went back out to LA and took that job and then eventually had to find work in the industry and started doing that once I was done my film, my camp counselor bit.
You know, it's not linear, is it? I think for so many people, like, particularly when you're younger, you think, okay, I want to be a lawyer or I want to be in the film. And you kind of just go, okay, what do I need to get there? And you think of like the end. But the reality is like we do zigzag all over the place. And I reckon it's the zigzag that's actually what's really fascinating and interesting, because if you can keep moving forward with the zigzag and get to where you thought you were, then you really, really want it.
I will say a note about the zigzag thing. It's really interesting you say that, because I got a lot of heat when I got into the industry, when I moved back to try and start finding jobs. And I had different jobs in different departments. And I got so much, can I say shit?
I got so much
shit from people who had been in the industry for a long time saying, you're never going to find a job. No one's going to hire you because you keep dipping your feet in different pools and you're not being, you know, linear. And I just was like, you know what? I'm trying to figure out what makes sense for me and nothing has clicked yet. So I know I don't like directing. I don't want to direct. I'm not a creative person. I love logistics and I love organizing. I like this. And then when I fell into casting, it was like, oh, I get to do logistics, but I also get some creative and this is fun. And I get to meet people and I get to travel. And like, it just made sense to me, but I got a lot of slack for the zigzag. But I actually now encourage people to do the zigzag because I'm like, I would never be where I am if I had kept going in the direction I thought I really, really wanted, which turns out I didn't want.
I think it's a very small percentage who just truly know what they want. I think for the rest of us, we might like the idea, but we have no understanding of it to really commit to it.
Yeah.
So it is, people could do it at any stage of their life, but similarly to you, like my 20s were all about like exploration in different areas to find out actually what's the calling and not just the calling, what is the calling that you like?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about dealing with criticism because, you know, I'm sure in LA you probably deal with a little bit of criticism, but in those early days when you're trying to make your way into a path that's your professional career, what did you say to people or how did you mentally process people going, well, you're not meant to be here because you haven't done the hard yards like we have?
So my very first job when I moved back to LA, I just needed a job. After I finished the camp counselor gig, I was like, crap, I have to find a job. I'm just going to start This was in 2006. So all you could really do back then is call like studio hotlines, almost operators, and say, hey, can I talk to so-and-so? Like there wasn't job postings online. And I called NBC Universal and I said, I'm looking for someone who hires production assistants. Can you connect me? And this woman was like, I'll connect you to the production safety manager of the show Las Vegas with Jimmy Kahn and Josh Duhamel. And I was like, okay. Like I wasn't going to say no. So I called him. I ended up getting hired. I was the production safety manager on that show for all of, I think it was season 4. And I have never faced so much adversity and challenge in my life. I was 24, maybe 25. And my job was to tell industry professionals who have been doing their job longer than I've been alive, you can't do this, you can do that, da, da, da. You have to clear the fire lane. Like I was like the safety police, which no one likes. So I had to tell them, move the fire lane, don't stand on that top step of the ladder, come down. I had to write people up sometimes. And in a male-dominated field, they looked at me like, who's this blonde-haired, blue-eyed young chick, like whatever. And they would never listen to me. They basically were like, fuck off. And I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know. But that just drove me more. It set a fire under my ass, I think, for lack of a better term, to just be like, all right, well, you're going to give me respect even if you don't respect me. Because I've trained, I've had to go through hours of preparation, hours of training. I had to get certified in all of this stuff. And everyone has to start somewhere. And I just be like, okay, fine. Like, you can say what you want. I'm going to let it roll off my shoulders. I'm here to do my job. I'm not here to make friends with you because you clearly think I'm a joke. And they just were like, all right, whatever. And I just did my job. I kept my head down and I was like, the way I was brought up was you just go through it and do it. And that helped. I mean, later down the road when I was in casting years later, there was an unfortunate, situation in which someone that I looked up to, and in casting, and I kind of parted ways, and I had worked for him and under him for quite some time. And that kind of came to an end, and it was not great. But at the same time, it was like, I can either let this hold me back and deter me from trying to move forward and reach my goals, or I can just be like, all right, this happened, whatever, and just be like, you know what? I'm going to fucking prove everyone wrong, and I'm going to go for it. And I literally have not looked back. And I think that's just a testament of why I am where I am now, which is just like, you can say what you want, go for it. I'm just going to keep going, and you can just see me at the top.
Yeah, well, I mean, do you feel comfortable talking about why you parted ways?
No.
Totally fine. Well,
I don't want to bad talk him, and it was a long time ago. I'll just say that, you know, you live and you learn, and there's a lot of people that you think have your back and maybe at the end of the day do not. And it's unfortunate, but at the same time, if that hadn't happened, I don't know if I would be where I am now. So I'm fortunate in some ways for that. And I learned a lot, you know, you learn a lot, both good and bad.
You know, I agree with that. I think you do learn a lot when you're faced with adversity. And the reason I think that is because when the going is easy, you kind of cruise. You can step into like default mode, autopilot. But it's when things get hard that I think you're really challenged to think, I guess, almost outside of yourself. You're forced to think of your interactions, the way you show up. And I think that can be where we really grow as human beings. So with casting, you've been in this career path for a really long time now. You've set your own company. What was the point where you started to be able to be selective with the jobs that you take on? Or are you not selective? Do you pretty much say yes to everything?
Oh, man. I was not selective on jobs up until probably 2 or 3 years ago. And I've been in casting now since 2006 or seven, because you never want to say no. Cause you never, when you work freelance, you're an independent contractor. So like casting gigs can be anywhere from 2 weeks to maybe 3 or 4 months. Shark Tank, I'm lucky because I'm on it for 9 months.
Wow.
And so that's unheard of. Cause again, most casting shows, you just quickly turn it over. So I just said yes to everything back in the day because I didn't know when my next paycheck was going to come. My mother was paranoid because she was like, Mindy, how are you going to pay rent? And how are you going to survive? And I'm like, well, and for me, I knew that I had to grow. I did not ever picture myself being casting as my career down the line. I just was like, all right, I just need a job. I just need a job. So I would take everything and anything. It didn't really matter. So that's why I took a job. Like my first job was living in a pink mansion in Chatsworth, California with 22 mothers and daughters. And everyone thought we were shooting a porn because Chatsworth is the porn capital of the world.
And it was a pink mansion.
I know. Yes, exactly. So like how much worse can it get? And then from there I was like, I just need another job. So you take it. It wasn't until again, the last 2 or 3 years that I was like, well, if I can financially afford to take time off and I'm comfortable with it, and I don't want to take a show because I have to, then maybe I'll enjoy 2 or 3 months off because I just busted my butt for Shark Tank or whatever show or you know, World's Toughest Race Eco Challenge. How long was that? That was a year long, almost over a year long job for me. And so, you know, I didn't really start getting selective until recently. And that's just because I was like, okay, I kind of can be, and I still don't like having more than 2 weeks off because I get bored and I always want to be doing something. And I'm just driven. I also have to be really into the show. If I'm not into the show, then it's like, maybe I'll pass.
Well, particularly when they're, you know, a year long or they're 9 months long, maybe there doesn't need to be as much investment if it's just a 2-week gig as you might've done in the earlier days.
Yeah.
Do you think with Shark Tank being, you know, 9 months of the year, that stability opened up freedom? Because you kind of know that you have that for X amount of, you know, in an industry that's so insecure, that's given you stability?
Yes and no. With Shark Tank, everyone's like, oh, it's going to go on for so long and everything. And I'm like, we literally wait for a green light every year. We're never guaranteed. Something I've learned is I've worked on many shows that we cast the whole thing and then they pull it. They just never green light the show. And so even with Shark Tank, people think I'm joking and I'm like, yeah, well, hopefully we'll get another season. And I'm like, I don't know if we'll get another season. You just never know. So I always just kind of, I do have security in that I know how to do my job and I believe I do it well and that I have it for 9 months. And, you know, just depending if I want time off or not, then I will. But Shark Tank, because I've been on the show since season one and I started that show when I was 24, 25, and now I'm 37. It's like, I could do that show. I know that show so well. Like you could literally say, oh, I saw this pitch one time and I'll be like, yep, I know exactly the one you're talking. Like I have this crazy amount of knowledge in my head about the show, which comes in handy.
I mean, have you always had such a retention, like a memory retention?
Yeah. It's a blessing and a curse because I'll remember something you said, like, especially in like relationships. I'm like, no, on this date, you said that, like I'm that person. If I'm really passionate about it, you know, but it comes in handy because when you're pitching people, you have to remember their stories or what makes them stand out. So it comes in really good, but I've always been really good with memory, always.
Well, then let's say someone's listened to this conversation. They're like, oh, this casting thing, this sounds interesting. What would you say are three attributes that have been helpful for you in this career path?
You have some hard and good questions, Sam. You've never asked me these on all the podcasts I've been on. Three attributes. You got to be willing to talk to anyone and about anything. There's going to be topics that you're like, oh God, you just have to ask because that's your job. And be willing to not be afraid to walk up to someone and say, hey, you have this look, or hey, I noticed this. Like, are you interested? So you have to be kind of an outgoing personality yourself. I would say be motivated to find the stories that drive people, and separate them out.
I mean, all I keep thinking back to is each year I've known you, I feel like I've known you for years, but
because I've almost seen 2 years now.
It's 2 years. Cause I've seen this photo twice now where at the end of each season, you put up a picture of all the applications, which are printed out because obviously people used to submit them via mail and I guess they can now do it online. But there are boxes and boxes and you basically create your casting like fortress and you're standing, it's like all your babies and you're holding them gently. And I think of that and I'm like, oh my gosh, like the administration logistics of that. Where did that kind of ability to be so organized come from?
My parents, 100%. My mother is very organized and she was always the one who would like instill, you got to do these chores by this time. Da-da-da. This is how you wash the dishes and everything. And I remember being as a kid, I was like, God, I hate this. This sucks. Da-da-da-da. And now I'm like, oh, it's coming in real handy. And I just thought of this the other day, like both my parents, my mom went to school later in life. She graduated and got her master's the time I was in college getting my bachelor's. My dad has never gone to college. He's self-taught himself and he works at a very prestigious private college in Maine where I'm from. And they're my heroes, like truly, because they, you know, where I'm from is a small town, you know, and they've both had to work their asses off. And between me and my sister's 10 years younger than I, we had a really good life, but they also like, they were both entrepreneurs now that I think about it, because my mom ran her own business. At the time, this was like in the '80s and nineties, she would basically write and people's resumes. That was her job. And my dad, even though he worked as a bus driver, for a high school, and then he worked as a radio DJ as well. He worked at a high school, then he worked at the college he's at now, but on the side, they would always do these extra things. Like he was a DJ for weddings and dances and he had his business. And then he would do my school dances. But then they also started a 4th of July celebration in our hometown that would bring in like 5,000 people. And they were on those committees. And then he started, you know, the street dance. And I'm like, now that I'm thinking about it, it's like, my parents did all of this while raising two kids. And I'm like, I barely can raise my dog by myself right now. And it's just watching them be so organized and everything. And like my dad, if you ever met my dad, he's one of the most quietest people you will ever meet. He doesn't talk. But you put him on a microphone and the man's personality doesn't want to, like, Brian, where'd this come from? But it's like his on-air personality almost. And so I 100% get it from them. The drive, the motivation, the multitasking, the organization, it comes from then. And I really, truly realized this like a week ago when I was like, oh my God, I'm getting all of this from them. Like, I've learned it by watching them 100%.
I mean, I love that because we don't have to do exactly what our parents did. In fact, we can end up in career paths that have nothing to do with what they would ever conceive. But we do inherit personalities, skill traits, the way we drive at things. And sometimes we do things differently because we see them being done from our parents. We're like, no, I want to take a different approach. But we are influenced greatly by our parents. And it sounds like your parents are kind of like hustlers and not the way that a lot of people would interpret it, but it sounds like they did what they needed to survive, raise a family, you know, in a small town, but still do things that they enjoyed, such as DJing. And like, you clearly couldn't have got up to any hanky panky at the school dance.
No, it was all. And then of course, when he would show up, like I'd be like, cool, my dad's going to DJ the dance. And then my mom would always be like, I'm going to come in and just like hang out. And I was like, oh, like I thought it was cool that my dad was there playing the music because my dad would never be like, Mindy, step away from the boy, you're dancing too close. But my mom would be like, I saw you dancing with so-and-so. So I hated her being there.
I love it that's how your parents embarrassed you. So I hope my mom doesn't listen to this because I don't want her to feel bad. But my mom made me wear a pink taffeta dress that she made with puff sleeves to my first ever disco. School disco.
Wow.
And I just remember being like, can't I wear jeans? I didn't even own a pair of jeans. Like my parents were like, no, girls don't wear, you know, jeans or I could never wear tracksuit pants. And it's hilarious because I live in them now. But I had to wear this. My mum kind of always would make stuff. And at the time I was like, I just want to get something from, you know, the store, like a retail shop. But no, I'd go and I just was mortified walking into that disco with this pink taffeta top and everyone was like in cropped tops and jeans and everyone's singing like the Cat's in the Cradle and the Silver Spoon, like Cat Stevens. And I'm like, oh God, can I get out of here? But you know what? Parents are doing the best that they can do, I think really for the most part, at what they have. And if only we could have like a time machine and reflect back on that, because I look at those situations now and I'm still embarrassed when I think of the pink taffeta. But I go, my mum wanted to make me something. Like she cared about me enough that she was using her skill set to construct what she thought was like an Anne of Green Gables outfit.
Watch Anne of Green Gables with my mother. So...
with the puff sleeves.
Oh, I love that.
Now, sidestepping from Anne of Green Gables, you know, before we jumped on this recording, we were actually talking about, you know, that entrepreneurial journey, something that you view all the time. You know, you hear the stories of entrepreneurs, their struggles, their successes. And the reality is I've always seen you as an entrepreneur. You have a business and you've assembled a very successful small team to be really effective at the job that you do in casting. And so I was wondering, what have been some of the things that you've learned about assembling a small team?
So for me, I feel like because of all my years of casting, I've been able to learn how to get a good read on people, on their energy. Obviously, when you're interviewing people, you're like, okay, their energy, you don't know about their work ethic. You kind of either take them at face value or you hope that they get a good referral, but then they may, you know, not really vibe with you. I will say that, and I'm not saying this, I've been told this, is that since I took over heading up Shark Tank casting, because I used to kind of be second in command for the last four seasons, my team has all come to me and separately and said, this is the best show I've worked on and this team is amazing. And somehow I just have this good instinct, I suppose, which is interesting because I never used to listen to my instinct in some regards of my life, but now I do. I have this good instinct, I guess, on how to pick people who I can read their personality. I can get a quick kind of read on their vibe, their personality, their energy, and hope that their work ethic is good. And if it's not, then it's like, all right, I'll pull them aside and be like, all right, we're going to figure this out. Like, I don't put anyone down. I always want to encourage people and build them up. And it's like, if they don't make for a good fit next year, that's okay. It doesn't mean they're a bad person or a bad worker. It's just, maybe it doesn't gel. But at the end of the day, my team that I work with on any show is, you become a small family and you really have to have a good time. For me, if I'm not doing what I love, then what am I doing? Like, I truly love what I do. And everyone's like, if there's that whole, you know, saying where it's like, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Yep.
And I think that's totally accurate. And I think you said this about Brian Finestone, who you interviewed. It's like, if the second you know that you're not, I think he said something about not making enough money.
If you start to feel resentful that you're not making enough money, then you need to reinvent yourself and do something else.
Yeah. And for me, it's like, I know what I'm doing is what I want to do. I love it. I feast upon the challenge that is presented to me. Because if you come to me and you say, I think this is going to be impossible to do, then I'm going to be like, I'm going to show you that it's not, and I'm going to get it done. And I go into this tunnel vision of, I'm just going to do it. My team and I will pull it off. And my team is hard on themselves. They're like, oh God, this was a bad week, or I don't have many people in the mix or whatever. And I'm like, you guys, it's just a TV show. Like, we're not curing cancer or anything. It's just like, get what you can. I'm not the person who bases things on how many people you get on the show. That's not what it's about. Is how's your work ethic? Did you do the work? Maybe you have one person on the show and I have seven and someone else has five. I still am going to hire you if I know that you're a hard ass worker. There are people who just like, okay, well, you didn't bring in this money, or they set quotas every week or every day. And I'm like, that's just not realistic. That's not how I like to operate. And I don't want people to be freaking out and panicking, because that is not useful time and energy of your work time.
So it sounds like you're not metric driven. You're more driven by how someone shows up and the energy that they give to the team.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's cool. And I have to like applaud you, and I've told you this personally, you know, from having been someone who's a part of a show that you casted for, I just couldn't get over how well your communication level is. And I always thought, oh, Mindy must really like me. She always is so quick to respond to me, and she's just so friendly. And then I got to Fiji and everyone individually thought that, and I'm like, oh, I don't think I'm that special. But then I was kind of like, what is the work rate of this person? Like, how is everyone individually feeling like she can get back to them straight away? How many toing and froing with the world's toughest race did you have with all the competitors a part of that journey?
A lot. We had a ton. Now, I will say, when I was working on World's Toughest Race, I was also working on Shark Tank at the exact same time. And I hired a very, very strong, amazing person by the name of Ashley Holt. And I adore her. And we would not have been able to have gotten through it if I didn't have her.
Yeah.
She's like me. She probably works more hours than me sometimes. And to the point where I was like, Ashley, close your computer. It's time to stop. Like, just relax. Like, it's okay. I personally tell everyone, right now that's not the case. Normally I don't put work emails on my phone. I refuse. After a certain time, I go home and I'm like, I'm not going to do it. Right now with Eco Challenge, with World's Toughest Race registrations open, I am answering emails at all hours of the day and night. But you have to have a strong team. And Ashley was the one who, for the most part, once we selected the 66 teams, she liaisoned with the team captains, which is 66 people. But leading up to that, I was dealing with all the hundreds that registered, or thousands, I guess. And I will say that I just know how I would be on the receiving end. And when I'm emailing someone or applying for something or whatever, I just, at the very least, would like a responsive acknowledgement. And it goes such a long way. And so for the thousands of racers and athletes that have applied for World's Toughest Race, a lot of them have said, oh my God, recently someone said, the fact that you responded at all, like, most people apply for races and they hear nothing, if ever. And I was like, oh wow. I just know that if it was me, I would want something, some sort of response acknowledgement. And I just think that's good business and good customer service. And I've been like that since I bartended. It doesn't bode well necessarily with my friends and texting, because I'm the person that texts back immediately. And then I'm like, why aren't you texting me back immediately? So that I'm still getting used to, like, it's okay. But I just want people to know, like, we're here, you know, we appreciate, because everyone puts time and energy into these things. And I want everyone to feel appreciated and that they are in the mix and we haven't forgotten about them or lost, because it's just a really shitty feeling if you don't hear anything.
Yeah, people, I mean, the world's toughest race, Patagonia, you know, unknown date, unknown number of teams, unknown everything. So, I mean, I love the leap of faith of so many people. And, you know, if you're following any of the forums, there's a lot of passion and excitement. And, you know, everyone feels like they have a chance, because everyone does have a chance. You know, it's an open slate. It's an open possibility. I mean, how does it feel when you can't help but, I guess, to some extent get a bit invested in people's stories? You've seen them pour their heart out. When you know the reality is that only X amount of people are going to be able to get in, how do you kind of detach yourself and go, okay, this is just a job, you know, best of luck to everyone, but it can't work out for everyone?
It took some time to figure out that and kind of detach myself, which is hard. And it took years. Like, when I hire new people on Shark Tank, they are rooting for all their entrepreneurs that they get in the mix. And I mean, there's 20,000 that apply and only like 88 actually make it on air. So it's crazy. And, you know, I always tell everyone, just thank them and be kind to them and encourage them to keep going, whether or not Shark Tank happens and that stuff. What did you ask me, Sam? I already forgot.
Oh, just how do you detach yourself? How do you kind of not get too tired in like the personal story and the personal desire?
It's really challenging sometimes, because if you're working on like Shark Tank or a reality show, not World's Toughest Race, because that's a little different, but you're just like, man, these people have stories and you're rooting for them, and I will push and push and push. And sometimes they're just like, it's not going to happen. And it's like, sometimes in our team, we kind of take it personally. And I tell my team, I'm like, you can't take it personally. Like, I know you like them and you like them as a person and like they have this amazing story, but like, unfortunately, you have to kind of separate it. And it sucks, because for a while I felt like I'm a horrible person because I didn't do my job because I couldn't get them on. And the reality is that's not my job, is to get them on. My job is to give everyone the fair shot, level playing field of here's what makes everyone different. And then someone else has the hard decision of selecting. And then, you know, I still have to be the bearer of bad news, because like, I have to tell entrepreneurs, fortunately didn't get in. Or with World's Toughest Race, it was like, hey, all these teams, sorry, unfortunately, you're not going to, you know, be invited to do the race. So it's hard, but it's something that comes with experience and time that you just have to eventually learn. That's not the downside, but it's the difficult side of casting.
Yeah. Every job has things that you'll love and things that you'd rather not do, but it's the job. Does that mean that every single person who applies hears if they get in, or obviously you hear if you get in, but you hear also if you don't get in?
Not on Shark Tank. On Shark Tank, the whole rule is they only call with good news, not with bad. We just don't have the time or the manpower to call 20,000 plus people and say, hey. So we always tell everyone, if you haven't heard by July, they've passed. But we have honestly had people apply 7, 8, 9 years in a row, and then it finally worked out and they got on the show. And so when I tell everyone that timing is everything, they're like, oh, yeah, yeah. I'm like, no, it really truly is. Like, timing is everything. And I think that goes for any aspect of your life, professional, personal. Like, if you stop, and for me during quarantine and COVID and lockdown, it was a lot of self-reflection of just, how am I being in this world? And also there was a moment in Fiji, actually, at a camp that I've never shared the story with anyone, where I just had a moment of like, what the hell am I doing? Because of some Fijian woman I met at Lutu Village, and she completely just kind of warped my outlook on life in 5 minutes of a conversation.
In what way? What did she say to you?
So we were at Lutu, and it was just me, because my whole team was still at Camp 1 and definitely Camp 2. And I was waiting for a team, and I went into the room, or not the room, the tent, and I took a 2 hour nap or whatever. Got up. And when I got up, she was one of the women who was offering massages to the racers and the athletes when they came in. And she was sitting.
I didn't even know that happened.
Maybe it was there when you were, I don't know, but there was two in there. I didn't get a massage, but that they weren't for me. And her English wasn't great, but she was like, can I ask you a question? And I was like, of course. And I was getting dressed and, you know, it was kind of awkward because I was getting dressed, but I was like, no, it's fine. And she was asking me like, oh, where do you work? Where are you from? And I was like, you know, United States and everything. And she was like, are you married? Do you have any kids? And I was like, no, I'm single. And she asked how old I was. And I was like, I'm 30. What, I was 36 last year. And I was like, you know, what's your name? And are you from here? And she was born in that village. She was a widower. She had recently lost her husband, I think 2 or 3 months before. I'm going to get emotional talking about this. And she had a son and a daughter. The daughter and I were the same age. And her daughter moved to a different island in a different village. And her son was working as a policeman, I think in Natty or maybe in Suva, which was still on that mainland, just on the other side. And she looked at me and said, every day, she goes, I have 6 pigs, 1 cow. And she goes, every day I have to find food. And I started crying because you just realize, it was like a moment, like time stopped in that moment for me because it was such a beautiful village. The kids were everywhere. They were singing as teams were coming in. It was amazing. And it just was like, I literally stopped and I looked at the stars and I gave her a hug and I just started crying because I was like, this woman literally will only survive if she plants food and feeds herself. Like, that's the only way she can survive. Meanwhile, on the other side of this planet, my friends are out drinking, partying, working, whatever. We have all of this stuff at our hands and this woman barely can eat. And these villagers are the nicest people I've ever met. And she was like, can you come to my house? And I want to make you food. And I had to get to camp 3. Like I was in the middle. It was like an 8-hour drive to camp 4. And I was like, I have to go. I can't. And she wrote, she was like, write down your name. She wrote down her name and some sort of address for where her hut was in this village. And she said, when you come back to Fiji, you're going to come to my house and I'm going to make you dinner. And I lost it. But it was in that moment where I just thought, it's unfair. Like, it's just unfair. And it just really made me think like, okay, you are so fortunate for what you have, but there are people with so much less and they're so much happier than a lot of us. And what does that tell me? That we all can just cut down on stuff and you can be happy with less and simple. And I've never forgotten her. I have a photo with her. And if I ever get to go back to Fiji, I'm going to find her. And I don't know where I was going with the story, but she just changed my life in an instant. Cause I just thought, okay. And that is why when I say to everyone, Fiji changed my life and this race changed my life, it did in a split second.
I mean, I never normally do video and like right now we're both in the whirls of emotion, but you know, who would have thought an adventure race would like teach this to you or expose you to that type of humanity and distill to you like gratitude for what we have and the reminder, like we don't need much to be happy. And I think COVID has taught us this because like, you know, for Mark and I, are in a week, our entire work for the rest of 2020 just disappeared like that. you know, where corporate speakers, I'm an endurance athlete, every race that I had planned, every corporate talk that I was going to do around the country, all the trips that I was going to have went. And we were like, let's not try and create a solution to something that we don't even know is the problem. Let's just be in the moment and remind ourselves what we have. And then we realized, just like this lady, when it all boils down and everything is taken away, the most important things are your family, yeah, your friends, and this sounds so terrible, but and food.
Yeah.
Because like you need that. And yeah, and I just said to Mark, I'm like, we have all those things. Like because we can call our friends, we can call our family, they're still there, and we have food and we have shelter. And it, you know, I also realized we don't need anywhere near as much money as we thought we needed. In fact, sometimes it gets in the way of thinking that you've got to keep doing stuff, and like you
absolutely
don't. I think a great lesson, and for people, and I think that's what people who are watching like the World's Toughest Race on TV, you know, then there's people who apply for this race who aren't even adventure racers, and partially I think they're in for a rude shock if they get in. But I think what people are drawn to is humanity and people coming together, despite the odds, despite your background, whether you've had something, whether you've had nothing, that you can toe the start line being, what's the analogy that Kev Hodder gave? You can be like the Michael Jordan of the NBA against the high school basketballer, and you can stand on the same start line from, you know, 66 countries around the world. There is something very magic about that and living moment to moment. Because the weirdest thing is, in, you know, the developed world, we don't often give ourselves the opportunity to live moment to moment. We dwell about what's past and we fixate on what's to come.
Always.
And a race like Eco Challenge strips that all back. So my advice to everyone who's listened to this, who is applied, and I'm sure plenty of people who have applied are going to listen to it, you can find those experiences outside of the World's Toughest Race experience, because there are adventure races. You can also go camping with your family. You can go on adventures with your friends.
You go on a hike, you know, an hour outside of your home and have a completely different perspective. For me, I'm like, all right, like I have been motivated. Honestly, like I was in Fiji for Eco Challenge, but I didn't see the race because I was only at the camps. So watching it back, I watched the show, the whole thing over again twice. And I was like, man, like this is motivating me. Just go out and go on a hike, something. And it was when I met with Lisa Hennessy, before we even opened registration for the first season, the first time, she was like, Mindy, this show, I'm sorry, not the show, the race, because it is a race before it's a docuseries, the race is truly magical and it's a community. And I was like, okay, I get it. It wasn't until that moment in Fiji and I was surrounded by all the Fijians and just everyone, every single racer and athlete that was there was so kind. And from 30 countries, I did not expect to be greeted by so much kindness from so many different people from different backgrounds, races, religions, what have you. And it was just like, wow, we're all here for the same reason. And it was just the most positive experience I've ever been through and truly, truly magical. And it was almost like, oh my God, I don't want this. It's not even adrenaline, like this feeling to go away. So like, I'm kind of chasing that with a, you know, hopefully we get to go to Patagonia. And it's like, I'm chasing that because when you find people that are all there for the same cause and are all moving towards the same thing, it's just the energy is insane.
Yeah, you don't want to let go of that.
No, never.
And all the competitors will say that's what they experienced of the race management team. And I think, and obviously like all the race management team would say that about the competitors. So I think what's cool as well is like the real mutual respect on both sides. And like both people come together as family. And, you know, like that's what business organizations can be like as well. And, you know, we talked about small businesses, but in times of adversity right now and in Australia, like most in Victoria where I live, most small businesses cannot operate because of our lockdown. And it's a reminder for those people who live in those local communities to that business, what can I do to support them? And I think that's, yep. I think it's like, think of who is in your tribe.
Yeah.
And think of how you can support them and always know that the smallest things do really add up and will really count.
Absolutely. And I think now more than ever, that hopefully is what people are doing. It's like, okay, well, if I'm going to be, I'm not going out to eat in LA because I'm still not comfortable doing that, but I will order from restaurants just so I can help them. And it's like anything you can do, just especially now with being forced to stay at home and everything, I just hope that a lot of people, I think people personally speaking, don't like and have a fear of being alone. because then they have to, they are forced to face their problems. And I think a lot of people would prefer a distraction so they don't have to deal with it. And I think that being on lockdown, it forced everyone to slow down and kind of take a look in the mirror of like, okay, what am I doing? That's why you see people breaking up, getting together, moving away, like quitting their jobs or whatever. Not that, you know, some obviously lost their jobs, but I think people are just taking I hate to use the word pivot because it's so overused right now, but I think it's forcing a lot of people to do that. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I hope it's a good thing with a good outcome, but I think that remains to be seen.
I mean, you live on your own and you were in lockdown for quite some time. And I also know that you kind of are still treating yourself as in lockdown. Like you don't go out a huge amount. Like Mindy,
I haven't been able to eat since February.
Your first time is that you went to the beach was this week.
That is correct. And that is because someone challenged me and said, Mindy, force yourself to put your computer down and go to the beach for an hour. They said to go at night. And instead I went at sunset because I love sunset. So I did. And then I also went to the beach for a couple hours the other day just to lay in the sun because I just needed to recharge.
Yeah.
But otherwise I'm still scared to go and do anything.
Well, let's finish this with what are some ways that you restore yourself? Because you are successful at what you do, which means you know how to attack, but you also must know how to look after yourself with self-care. What's some of the things that you do that might be helpful for some people listening?
So I'm still a work in progress on the self-care part. I work really hard. I work fast and furious almost. And they always kind of say like work hard, play hard. And that's true to an extent. I try to shut my computer off at like 6:30, 7 o'clock at night and not look at any emails until the next morning, depending on what time of year it is and where I am in a show, or if I'm on registration for, you know, Eco Challenge, then I can't really do that much depending. But I love to travel. So when I'm allowed to, I like to go to Hawaii. It's my favorite place, but I'll go anywhere at this point outside of the United States when I can. Travel. I love to read, but I rarely get to. So I find that I usually only end up reading when I'm on a vacation. and honestly, because when I got a dog, almost a year ago, right after we came back from Fiji, I adopted a rescue. He's forced me to go outside 3 times a day now.
Yes.
Because I have to.
Yep.
So the good thing about, and actually your tack,
Joshy. Oh, did he?
At the closing party, at the after party of the closing party that we were talking about how I wanted to adopt a dog. And I was like, yeah, I need a name. And he's like, well, call him Wesley. And I'm like, that's my cousin's name. I can't call him that. And he goes, what about, in his little Australian accent, Dudley? And I was like, oh my God, I love that name. And when I found Dudley, he's the most Dudley dog ever. Like, it's perfect. But Dudley has forced me to go outside 3 times a day because I hate working from home.
Yeah.
I don't separate work from anything. That's it. So Dudley has helped me kind of go outside and be like, okay, walk around the block, get some sun, take a breather. And then honestly, working out is kind of the only other thing, the other outlet I have. I go to this place called Lit Method. It's not open right now, but we're doing online stuff. And the owners of that have changed my life, Justin and Taylor. And they actually have a very good kind of saying, which is, if it doesn't challenge you and it's not uncomfortable, you're never going to change and you won't grow. And I have, ever since Justin told me that, it's kind of been my mantra. It's like, all right, this is uncomfortable, but I'm going to grow from it. I'm going to learn. So I think travel, reading, my dog, and working out, it's kind of like 3 and 4, are the way that I do self-care. But sometimes it is a struggle to stop and be like, Mindy, just chill.
I think we're all a work in progress. And
always.
You definitely are someone who epitomizes that it's okay to be in discomfort, because in fact, that's when we're growing as individuals. So, you know, as opposed to have the rude shock of it, you can quickly go, oh, this doesn't feel great. What might I take away from this moment and where may I go? Mindy, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're a ray of sunshine, but you're raw and real, which is a potent combination. You know, I feel like I've known you for so much longer than we actually have. And I credit that to the fact that we shared an immersive experience together. You know, the entire casting process, completing the world's toughest race was just so powerful. And it really is like this thing that I'll always remember 2019 being about, and then 2020 being able to watch it back and sharing it with so many other people. And now a lot of people are going to want to know, how can they find you?
At Mindy Casting, MindyCasting on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And whilst Mindy said that she's very good at responding, I'm just going to give her a caveat. She's probably got a lot of stuff going on right now. So if you do reach out to her, just patience and grace, and she may eventually get to you.
I will admit, I rarely am on Facebook. I will like post stuff there, but I don't really look at it. Instagram is where I put all my time and attention, but the DMs, they are a lot, and so I try to get to some, but also I think sometimes some don't show up, so please don't yell at me. I will try.
And don't yell at me. Don't yell at me.
Don't yell at me.
That is a wrap of our conversation with Mindy. As she said, you can discover her on Instagram at Mindy Casting. She regularly updates on her experiences at the shows that she casts for and she works with. So you'll see lots of Shark Tank, lots of World's Toughest Race. You know, I really love what Mindy said, and when she goes, timing is everything. If you really want something, you've got to keep trying, because you never know when your time is right for you. I hope you guys loved it. I hope you're happy, safe, and well wherever you are. Looking forward to tuning in with you next week with a cracker conversation with Megan Hine. And I'm just going to say, go and check her out before you listen to the conversation, because you're going to love her story. See you later.